1, 2, 3. Just give me patience, yeah. Yo, Z-Pack. This episode is made possible by the generous sponsorship of Athena Health. Athena Health partners with hospital and ambulatory clients to drive results. They offer network-enabled medical record, revenue cycle management, patient engagement, care coordination, and population health services to build Health 3.0. Yo, get back to the work you love doing. Athena Health, free up.
Revenue cycle management, that is sexy. Yes. That is really sexy. Yeah. And speaking of sexy, Z-Pack, we're really excited because this month we're supported by Athena Health to help us get this Health 3.0 message out. And I have a guest with me that is going to be like, you guys are going to be like, who is this guy? And by the end, you're going to be like, who is this guy? That's how amazing he is. That's how amazing.
I thought you were referring to me as sexy.
Well, let's, you know.
We'll get into it.
What happens in Vegas gets sexy in Vegas. I'm here with Dr. Ryan Neuhoffel, D-O, M-P-H, P-I-M-P, out of Lawrence, Kansas, or the Republic of Lawrence.
People's Republic.
The People's Republic of Lawrence, the most liberal place in Kansas. And he is here because he is a single-handed agent of change to build Health 3.0, and we're going to talk about that today. We're going to talk about his clinic, New Care, which is transforming how you do primary care, stealing quite copiously.
Most of it.
From my own Turntable Health, which is now from the ashes arises the phoenix of another man with my favorite type of haircut.
Mine's much longer.
It's
at least a millimeter.
It's scruffy.
Yeah.
He also happened to single-handedly write a document about actually a healthcare plan that might actually work. So we're gonna talk about that too, how we can actually cover everybody while allowing the free market to operate, while providing tremendous care and incentivizing prevention and primary care. So I'm really happy to have you, brother.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming all the way to Vegas,
yeah,
where there's nothing to do.
The strip would say otherwise. Yeah. The strip would say otherwise.
You already saw a guy running in a Speedo, right?
He was very patriotic.
Was he?
In his Speedo, yes.
So
yes.
It was like an American flag Speedo.
That could be described as such, yes.
You do have a master's in public health.
I do.
It could be described as such. You have to use a passive voice.
Yes. Oh,
the abdomen was entered and a number 3 scalpel was used with...
People watching is good here. I'll say that.
Yeah, it definitely
is.
Is it as good in Lawrence, Kansas?
It rivals it, actually. For a small town in the Midwest, you'd be surprised that we have some of the best people watching all over America.
Is that why the Russians blew it up in the movie The Day After in the 80s?
I don't remember the plot, but I'll presume so.
How old are you, by the way?
36.
Oh my gosh, you're so young. He's a baby.
Yeah.
He's a child.
I don't feel it.
Well, because you went through medical school.
I have 4 kids.
And you have 4, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Wow. I'm sorry. And yet, congratulations.
It's okay. Yeah, it's my fault.
So this is the thing. You have 4 kids. You went through osteopathic medical school. Mm-hmm. You probably think a little bit bigger because you have a master's in public health.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so you came into the world of actual practice of medicine and were like, okay, I could either work as a slave in the Health 2.0 matrix, clicking boxes for the man, or I could work for a big company as part of an integrated model, or you could do what you did, which is entirely remove yourself from the grid and practice that relationship-driven care that we went into medicine to do, but that's also technologically enabled, that's also part of a bigger whole, that sort of transcends the old vestiges of Health 1.0. So tell me how all this sort of started with New Care.
You know, I guess my public health training did give me a different perspective going in, because I finished most of my work before medical school, and, you know, I would say it started before that. I shadowed a doctor, a family doctor, kind of the prototypical country doctor in my wife's hometown. I didn't do so great my freshman year in college, and so...
I know that feeling.
Yeah, and so my advisor said, you know, I was a geek and taking biology classes, but I wasn't pre-med, and so my advisor said, you gotta figure out what you wanna do with your life. So I kind of matched in this program at the University of Kansas and ended up in my wife's hometown and shadowed a doctor for the summer. And he, again, was a prototypical country doctor, and, you know, I think he was kind of semi-retired, but he was a farmer slash doctor, and I just thought it was this amazing thing. He had these great relationships with his patients and had this broad spectrum of knowledge and thought, I want to do that. So I had to get much better grades throughout undergrad and make up for lost time.
So your inspiration was really Health 1.0, this old
In a way, yeah. It was, you know, and you're very naive, obviously, being 20 years old. I have no family members in medicine. So just really saw his kind of relationships with his patients. You know, and I didn't know what was right or wrong at the time. And but that's kind of what inspired me. And then going and getting a public health degree before medical school, you start looking at more of the systemic stuff. So I think when I went into medical school, I was looking at it both from kind of the personal side of things, like the rewarding aspect of medicine, the relationships, but also kind of a systemic level. And so I realized pretty early on in medical school, when I got to third and fourth year, that it was nothing like what I thought it was going to be. Yeah. Like, I mean, within the first few months, and I thought...
Was it rotation?
Yeah. And I thought, holy crap.
Did you, and tell me honestly, because, and again, I don't mean to interrupt you, but this is a conversation that I have mentally with myself and with anybody who's in medicine. And I'm stuck with these two clowns and they don't do medicine. And so we don't talk about this and I need therapy.
They're not over there. Don't worry about talking about them.
Yeah. They can't hear us, right? They're
like
children.
They're to
be heard, neither heard nor seen.
They have earmuffs.
Earmuffs. Perfect. The thing is, that third and fourth year where you're exposed to the clinical practice of medicine and how the attendings are thinking and how it's actually practiced and how the people fall through the cracks, did you despair? Did you actually look at the janitor like I did and go, that guy has a great job, I'm going to have a terrible job?
Yeah, I mean, I despaired in the sense that I didn't know what I wanted to do. You know, I knew I wanted to do primary care. I knew I wanted to do family medicine or ped, somewhere in that realm. But, you know, as you go throughout your third year, you're like, okay, where am I going to end up? You know, not just what specialty I'm going to be, but I was thinking beyond that. And so I experienced all the different settings that you can practice in, you know, suburban clinics, safety net clinics, rural clinics, urban clinics, academic medicine, and all of them I just thought kind of stunk and in their own ways. You know, there are certain aspects of my life. So I realized by the time I finished medical school that I didn't really have a way to fulfill the vision of what I wanted to be. And part of that was based on my experience all those many years ago. But I didn't know quite how to get there.
Right. So when you chose family medicine, you went through the residency, what led you to do what you're going to do? And we're going to walk through with the ZPAC what it is that new care is.
Yeah.
And it truly is a new type of taking care of patients. But that's really the old way that's empowered with something different.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I had read about some kind of innovators in primary care back probably in the late 2000s. Garrison Bliss in Seattle, I think, is the very first doctor I read about.
He's
and
my
I thought,
homie,
holy crap, like, this is amazing. Why doesn't everyone do this? Why, you know, this is the future. You know, I thought by the time I graduated residency, this was going to be the future. It just made so much sense to me.
And let me just, for the ZPAC sake, so Garrison Bliss ran started a company called Q-Lions, which only recently closed. And the idea was that flat fee, unlimited access to primary care, kind of off the insurance grid, and just go back to taking care of patients in an old-fashioned way, where for a membership fee, you have access to a primary care. And the idea is prevent disease, and then you have wraparound insurance that then pays for catastrophic stuff if you get very sick, need a surgery, et cetera.
Yeah.
And Garrison was one of the pioneers, and I had the pleasure of actually meeting him up at Q-Lions, and he's a character, he's a revolutionary, he hates the system, he wants to fix it. So he was one of your inspirations.
Yeah, I think so, and what I saw was that they'd kind of stripped away all of the bullcrap, all of the administrative bullcrap that everyone, you know, laments.
Thank you for not cursing on Sunday.
Oh, man,
I know you want to.
I should have, I know.
Before we started.
I know, I was going to say this, that I'm kind of ashamed, because I always promised that I was going to out-curse you if I ever got the chance. And as fate turns out, it's Sunday.
You come back for an incident before you curse
all you want.
Anyway, Garrison Bliss.
So sidebar. Hi, Grandma. I saw that they had kind of stripped away all of that stuff that frustrates people, and it made so much sense to me. And so I think Garrison was the first person to use the phrase direct primary care. And really, there was only a handful of doctors around the country as I was kind of graduating residency doing this. And so there really wasn't a good template, and so I really just made it up.
Yeah.
And I'm still making it up to some degree, but I think that freedom is what's absolutely missing in healthcare, that we're all kind of chasing one program after another without thinking about our patients and actually improving the community of the health of our community. And DPC allows doctors to focus on that as opposed to the paperwork and, you know, the revenue.
And again, like, just so people know, direct primary care, and this was what Turntable was. It was a different flavor of it than what you're doing, but very similar. And the idea is that you take the direct insurance out of the equation, and it's just a fee to take care of patients, to keep them well, to see them when they're sick and when they're well, to be a part of their lives, to integrate into your community.
Yeah.
And I think what separates your model from some of the earliest models is that you're trying to use Everything at your disposal, not just the facilities and other things, but the technology and
to tie
it all together and to practice in a way that I had Robbie Pearl on the show from Kaiser.
Yeah.
And you know, he is sort of, he's another counterpoint to this. His is like, no, to reform healthcare, you don't get independent docs going out in the community and setting up a shingle and saying, I'm going to take this much money and take care, keep you well, because they're not integrated with other specialists. They're not integrated with other primaries. They don't have the health IT. They don't have the economy of scale. They don't have the incentive to actually practice really good outcomes-driven medicine. And to that you say...
Oh, well, that's a bag of worms.
Yeah,
there's
a
lot of stuff there. Well, you know, my vision has always been to take really good care of my patients. And I saw that the way that the insurance system was set up was more of a distraction than a help. And so I think a lot of people misperceive that direct primary care, at least the movement, is anti-insurance. I just don't think it makes a lot of sense for routine care. If something's predictable and we can manage it for a relatively affordable cost, and we'll get into that and what that means. But you know, I think it distracts us more than it helps us.
The idea of like using auto insurance to change your oil, to rotate your tires, that's what we do now.
Yeah.
So we're insulated from it. And it also creates inefficiencies of care. And it creates waits. So here's the thing, what I'd love to do is you have a YouTube video where you walk through your clinic.
Oh, yeah.
And we dug it up and we took away your voiceover because your voiceover is like, hi, I'm Dr. New and this is my clinic.
It sounds just like
Exactly. So we're going to do the voiceover in real time. We're going to take the Z-Pack through your clinic.
Cool.
And is that okay with you?
It's fine.
Let's do that. So Logan, go ahead and roll the clip. We'll watch and we'll voice over here. So this is Lawrence, Kansas. Dr. New's clinic, and there we are in our little box.
Oh, yeah, it's my parking lot. It's empty.
Oh, yeah, it's totally empty. Why? Because you have no patients?
I think this was the Saturday.
Oh, okay.
Although I do work on Saturdays.
When do all the drug seekers come? Is it Friday? Is that
they generally avoid me. I have a good reputation in town.
Which we'll talk about.
Yeah.
So in through the front door, you get in, and there's your sign, New Care, and you've got a little doctor's bag, and that's an old school doctor's bag.
It is, very old school, and
holy
I really have one of those.
Crap, look at that lobby. So you've got the cool hip pallet wall thing, and
I think they call it industrial chic.
It is both chic.
I've
and
heard
industrial.
That somewhere.
It's a good phrase. I'm going to steal it for my underwear choices. So there's your New Care thing, and then look here. You've got a little kids play area, and what's the screen?
You know? So I really look at our lobby here as not a waiting room, but a community space.
Yes.
And so we really don't have wait times. Like I think our wait time is probably a negative. And what we're really using that space for, and we just moved into this a few months ago, but we're going to use it for community education, group visits, those type of things. So we don't really look at it as like a waiting room. That's why there's not a lot of chairs.
That's brilliant. And this is like your...
A wholesale. We do one of the cool things a lot of DPC doctors do is a wholesale medication.
Can you pause it, Logan? Yeah. So wholesale medications.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit more about that.
Yeah. So I think of DPC model as kind of Costco for primary care.
Yeah.
So Costco is kind of based on a membership fee, and all the other charges that Costco charges their customers are kind of at cost. I think that's how Costco got its name.
Right.
And so DPC does that with ancillary services. So we do that with wholesale medications, labs, radiology. So a lot of our patients are saving, you know, hundreds of dollars on these things. You know, they get great primary care and in an innovative way, but they're also, you know, on the back end of that saving a lot of money.
So they're kind of getting your cost, your wholesale cost for the medications, for the lab tests, for simple tests and things. And you do any procedure that you can do at the top of your license in that normally you might refer and they would charge another copay. So in a way, by paying that, which, by the way, what are your fees?
It ranges from $35 to $75, but my actual, when you add in family discounts and stuff, it's about $43 per member per month.
So the average of $43 per member per month.
And I don't live in a cheap part of Kansas, mind you. I know most people say, oh, that's in Kansas, but I know DPC doctors around the country, and I think the average is probably in the $60 to $70 range
the
country.
We charged around $80 at Turntable. We had a lot more overhead, and honestly, if you can get a sweet spot there, because then you're talking about $500, $600 a year to have unlimited access.
Yeah.
To this, and you're buying sort of discounts on the drugs and the other things. And you still need insurance, right?
But
it's catastrophic high deductible insurance.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think at the foundation of people's care, they should think about their healthcare. And I think that's where, you know, healthcare gets very emotional and very polarized really quickly.
Yeah.
Because whenever you start going down this path about how this should all work, you know, there's health, which is obviously complicated. There's health care, and then there's health insurance. And those are three distinct things. And whenever I hear politicians or you know, people who are very political talk, you know, they often just use those terms interchangeably. And so you have to be very careful. And whenever I talk, I try to, you know, use the appropriate word where it's appropriate. But you know, a lot of people say, I lost my job and I lost my health care. Well, you know, kind of in a way. And so I think whenever you go down that path, you kind of have to be careful about the language that you use when you're talking about how to structure everything.
Well, and this is why, you know, when we talk about healthcare debates in Washington, we're not really talking about healthcare. We're talking about health insurance reform.
Yeah, for the most part.
For the most part. Yeah. And that's why I think this is so important, because what you're doing here is a mix. You're reforming the care at the bottom end. You're also reforming how you're paying for it.
Yeah.
And you're reforming how you're taking middlemen out of it.
Yeah.
So let's go back to the tape and walk through some more. This is great. So there's your centrifuge, maybe?
No, it's a pill counter. A mechanical pill counter. Yeah.
Wow.
So we have a little lab. We do basic point of care stuff.
Can you pause it again? So you were able to dispense medications legally in Canada?
44 states basically have no restrictions. You can dispense and sell. It's the same laws that govern samples and that type of stuff. But examples here. So most medicines that are generic, this is not true of brands, are about 50 to 80% cheaper than what the pharmacy sells them for. So we do a lot of chronic disease meds for less than $1 a month. I think amlodipine's 50 cents a month.
Yeah, and again, part of this is because you're taking middlemen out, like the pharmacy benefit managers.
Oh, yeah,
PBMs,
yeah, yeah.
And these other horrible entities that are just adding no value at all.
Yeah.
Let's hit play on that again. I want to see the rest of this clinic. It's a nice polished hall.
Yeah.
I love that.
This is my nurse's room right here. My nurse, Donica, does most of her work in here. I think I scan up here to the vampire's lair, which our patients always find funny.
Ooh.
So my clinic is, it looks like it might have some space in here, but it's just me and an RN, and I just recently hired a nurse practitioner.
Okay, pause it for a second, sorry, before we look at this room, because this room's amazing, but I wanted to talk about your nurse and your nurse practitioner.
Yeah.
So your whole staff is you?
Right now, it's just me and a nurse, an RN.
Wow, and you just hired an APRN family nurse practitioner?
Just recently, she's not even started with us yet. But
wow.
The whole model is based upon, when patients interact with us, I want someone clinical for the most part interacting with them. For us, when our patients call, it's either me or my nurse who answers the phone or responds to emails. So they don't have to kind of go through that phone tree that frustrates so many people.
Yeah.
And I think that, that kind of seems like not feasible to only have a nurse and a doctor running a clinic, but with our panel size and with not being distracted by billing and coding and documentation, it works very well.
Okay, so you said something really interesting here, because again, the theme of this month, we're working with Athena Health, and they're trying to create solutions to actually reduce the burden of doctors working in the current insurance structure.
Yeah.
And so one of the big problems is billing, coding, charting, regulatory compliance.
Yeah.
So the idea that the way you might start to approach that is say, well, I'm not going to do typical billing and coding.
Yeah.
And a way that a typical insurance payer relationship might work is, well, we need technology that actually helps that billing and coding become invisible to us. So there's different ways to slay that beast.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I mean, that's the game that insurance is. I mean, you get your revenue by billing more 99214s.
Right.
I mean, that's how it works. So I don't fault them for doing that. I think the payment model's broken. And so unfortunately, technology has gotten a little bit distracted from serving the purpose of healthcare. They're in the business of medicine. They're a fancy cash register. And then doctors and patients are kind of an afterthought. But I think that technology is not inherently bad. I know a lot of doctors and nurses rail on technology that it's like causing the problems. But I think for the most part, technology is doing what we ask it to do.
And do you think that your RN and your soon-to-be joining nurse practitioner are going to be able, do they practice at the very highest level of their abilities, or are they relegated to menial stuff like in many practices?
No. My first full-time nurse actually went to medical school. She left me to go to medical school. So, I think that whenever you can spend more time with a doctor, whether you're a nurse or an MA or whatever you are, you learn more.
Yeah.
We have these busy clinics with all these people, but people are kind of in their silos and they don't get to sit down and talk about the patients very much.
Right.
So if I was seeing 32 patients a day, would I really get to talk to my nurse, or would they more just be, doing post-it notes back and forth to me? So I think my nurses have been able to learn more and more because we spend so much time with each other talking about patients.
Do they get to do more and more?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. And that takes time.
Yeah.
So I've kind of viewed my nurse, as more and more like a nurse practitioner, because she, she's has a great background. She was in Peace Corps and
in Moldova.
In Moldova, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. I think you have to put that trust in nurses. But in order to do that, you also have to develop relationship with your nurses. And I think in healthcare, unfortunately, what I see is there's so much turnover and staffing and stuff that you really never get comfortable with that relationship.
And do you think that's a function of having to see 30 patients a day in this volume mill?
I agree. The burnout.
I agree. How many patients do you see a day?
Well, it's interesting. So I don't really measure my clinic by clinic visits.
Right, because that's not your revenue.
Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah. So I communicate with patients in all sorts of ways. So I would say half of the time that I'm taking care of people, it's a phone call, it's a text message, it's an email, and I don't have to bring people into clinic to make money. So I always preface this with that. I would say clinic visits, I see about 6 or 8 a day, and I spend 30 minutes to an hour on most visits, not all the time, but when they need it. But I would say for the most part, I care for people remotely.
So a couple amazing things here, because we did the same thing at Turntable. So 30-minute visits, usually minimum, often more like an hour. And that's when you're seeing them in the clinic.
Yeah.
But so much sort of remote stuff, and that's mostly what, phone, email, text?
Text message, yeah. However they want to communicate.
How humans communicate now.
Yeah, or I would with my family or friends.
Right.
Yeah, which is funny. Doctors, whenever I tell my friends that, who are physicians, they're like, you text message with
they're
your
horrified.
Patients? How could you do that? And I say, well, and I know we're not supposed to do this, but if your friend text message you and ask you about a rash or something, would you give them advice? Oh, yeah, they would think not twice about it.
Right.
But I'm like, well, why wouldn't you do that for your patient? Well, it just makes me feel uncomfortable. And my immediate response is, well, you must not care very much about your friends if you're comfortable giving them advice in that manner, but not your patients.
Right.
So I think this is an interesting dynamic.
Right, family.
Yeah.
Right.
And so I do know my patients really well, and I think that's what makes a difference. You know, if I had a group of 4,000 patients in a huge practice with tens of thousands of patients, and I've had random patients who I didn't know really well doing that, I mean, that would be probably very dangerous. But since I do know my patients very well, and I invest a lot of time up front with them. So it makes those things more feasible.
More feasible.
Yeah.
I want to see this room because this reminds me a lot of the consult room we had at Turntable. Go ahead and hit play there. So
oh,
look
yes.
at that. So can you hit pause for a second, Logan? Okay, so you've got sit-down furniture. You've got a monitor there. You've got places for family to sit, and you've got the laptop that I assume has also an EHR.
So basically what we're doing here is we're setting people kind of in a casual setting. And I would say 50% of the time, even when it's in clinic, I just sit and talk.
Yeah.
Even if it's like a minor sick visit. And so what I'm doing is really kind of allowing them to be a partner. You know, and I want to show them everything.
Heaven forbid. So they actually look in the chart.
Yeah, as I'm talking. Even if I want to show them their own x-rays or lab reports, so I have a 32-inch monitor up there, and that's kind of what I'm mirroring up on that display.
So guys, Health 2.0 currently, you would just type 23-year-old drug seeker here to manipulate me because
Well, sometimes it may not be appropriate.
They're never going to see it. Sometimes it's not
appropriate. Tom came and asked for his Dalalas, I'd probably have to not mirror that. Yeah.
Right, Tom?
I want some Dalalas.
I knew it would only be a matter of time before that came.
Hey, guys, real quick, I'm stupid. So one of the things a stupid guy like me wants to ask is, what happens when you need a specialist?
Well, not a stupid question.
Not a stupid question. Yeah. So I think that, parsing words here, healthcare is this really broad and diverse thing. We say healthcare like it's this one thing. Mm. But we all know that neurosurgery or intensive care versus primary care versus ER, all these different things.
Very different, yeah.
And so I think whenever I describe what I do and say, I'm a primary care doctor, there is an end to that. Mm. If someone gets ran over by a bus, if someone needs a specialist, you have to think about that part of it. And I do, if my patient needs a specialist, there's a couple options I have. There's some really great platforms out there that are telehealth, telemedicine specialist platforms where I can ask specialist questions of them. So I would say 50% of the time, I just need to ask a specialist, hey, can you help me interpret this and what's the next step?
I would agree with you. About half the time as a hospitalist, I just need to talk through
curbside,
something.
We call it curbside.
Curbside
but
with
sometimes, in the real world, that's curbsiding, it gets difficult.
See, the problem with curbside is they don't get paid.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
The question is, again, about integration and there may be clever, and there's apps now that
those
guys do
ones.
Get paid a little bit.
Yeah, there's some great ones. Yeah.
Exactly. So there are ways to get around that. And then you have insurance to cover the cost of inpatient.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think at some point, because you're looking at financially at that point, like what is a reasonable amount for a person to presume financially?
Right.
And that's going to vary a lot. Some people, $100 is too much. Some people could carry a deductible of $10,000 and be okay with that. I mean, if I was a billionaire, I wouldn't carry insurance at all.
Right.
Because it wouldn't make any sense.
Pay out of pocket. Yeah.
I think you have to look at the financial aspect of that, but also kind of the healthcare and how to do it most efficiently first before worrying about how to pay for it. And I think what we're doing is kind of the inverse. We're kind of worrying about how to pay for it and not even caring how efficient or expensive it is.
I agree. Hey, hit play, Logan. I want to see something here. So the thing about these consult things, it's funny, because go ahead and pause it again and just leave it up for a second. The thing about these consult rooms is you get some comments here. It's like, that's all fine and dandy until someone pukes in there.
well, if they're green, I wouldn't bring him to that room.
Right.
I've been in my nurse's room.
You're not going to do that. You bring him to the nurse's room, which is different. Now, this
room.
This room is worse off in Moldova, believe me.
Oh, yeah.
Those guys are throwing up all over the place. This room is really what we found in Turntable. It's where the real, actual bulk of our care happens.
Yeah.
Because it, so much of it is supertentorial, is listening to somebody, is getting in at the root cause, is talking to them, is forming a plan, getting at the goals and their hopes, dreams, and fears. And it's forming that relationship that is missing in our insurance-driven mill because we don't get paid to form the relationship. Yeah. We don't have the time to form the relationship. We're not incentivized to form it. And and again, it's a broken model.
I was used to make fun of psychiatrists and psychologists for having sofas, but after having one, I know why they do.
Yeah.
Because if people get comfortable enough, they share stuff.
They start sharing
stuff. And they don't share that in the first 10 or 15 minutes. And so sometimes, you know, I have to sit and patiently listen, which is a skill that doctors and everyone needs to learn. But it's amazing when people get into that 20 or 30th minutes, especially if, you know, a new patient visit, like they share like the most important thing at the very end of that.
Dude, this, and so here's the thing. In the current model, you get that sharing as the patient's walking out the door. One more thing, doc.
Yeah.
And you're on your next patient.
And they say you'll schedule November.
Next
March.
But the difference here, and it's the same with Turntable, is you get that in that visit. And not only that, but then you're going to have subsequent visits because you're not a transaction. You're a relationship now.
Yeah. And investing in them. And so sometimes, you know, I'll spend an hour with the patient, an hour and a half sometimes. And, you know, if you look at how much I charge, you're like, man, that's a really raw deal for me.
Right.
But I think that, you know, when you move away from kind of a fee for service, you know, the more patients you see, the more money you make, into kind of a retainer or subscription model, I think of it kind of the opposite. So I want to get all of my patients to the point where they're caring for themselves, because that's good financially for me.
That's true.
Of them I have to invest a ton of time up front, and some of them I think, oh my gosh, you know, I've seen them four times over 3 or 4 months, and with as much as I charge, I'm making less than what they would pay for a haircut for each visit. But I don't think about it like that because I want to invest that time to get them to a point where they are, you know, kind of on autopilot. I think that's what we should all be getting our patients to.
I love that concept. You're investing in their health, and that's going to pay not only them, obviously, but it's going to pay you back, because that means less intensive visits and more like text, email, Skype, those kind
of things. Yeah, and as you get to know people better, that becomes more and more. You know, and some of this might be a little bit silly, but you know, you really do get to appreciate, you know, people's nuances, the personalities.
Yeah.
So there's certain patients who call me, and I kind of know that even the tone of their voice or when to really be worried about something. And that you can call that intuition, or you can call it whatever you want. But that relationship, and not just knowing like the XYZ of their medical history, but kind of them as a person.
Yeah.
And so there's some people who call me with some concerns, and you know, I take everyone's concerns at face value. But there's some people who I may, you know, say, oh man, this person never is concerned about anything. So if they're concerned, like I should
I'm
be really
jump
concerned.
On this. Yeah. You can do that because you know them.
And that's hard to quantify.
Yeah,
it's hard to make
no.
objective.
Well, look, you're taking a page right out of the same experience that I had at Turntable. It's like same exact thing. And it's so hard to convince people sometimes because they don't, like, the bean counters don't see the value of this.
Yeah.
But those on the front
clearly.
Line, clearly they don't, or else everyone would be doing it,
Or 5% of primary, we would spend more than 5% on primary care.
And 95% on the failure of primary care. Hit play, Logan. I want to see the rest of this. So there's your consult room.
Yeah.
And they see the EHR as you're
Those are the kids playing in the back. That's the most important thing.
That's key.
My kids donated those toys.
Oh, that's awesome. Is that Operation?
I think it's like a sock monkey thing.
I thought I saw
When I say donated, I mean I forced them to give away
Some of
their toys.
Yes. Because you're an
Just
evil...
To clarify. I have four of them, so way too many toys.
Fair enough. Yeah. Let's see. So we've got the cool bag, and there's your EHR.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk about health IT in a second.
Yeah, for sure.
But let's get into the next room, because I want to see this.
That's my chart, so no breaking of HIPAA there.
Hey,
right,
Doc.
Yeah.
I don't care for myself either. That's just a fake chart.
Tom. Kristen would like to know what's written on your left hand.
Oh, I have a B to breathe, because Zubin is so stunning that I have to remind myself to breathe.
I have an H. Hold my breath.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to breathe, because you're so gorgeous that I just
want
to.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's probably my hair, isn't it?
That's
it's all this, you know, 1 millimeter of hair I have.
If you need that to breathe, I mean, you're pulling it off without, you're fooling me into thinking you're just a star, buddy. Because I'll tell you, and Belen Amat asked, why did Turntable close? And actually, this is an interesting point, because we had a very similar model. We charged more, we had a bigger space, and we had an insurance partner.
Mm-hmm.
You know why we failed? We had an insurance partner. So the insurance partner paid the fee because in downtown Las Vegas, there weren't people who could afford the $80 a month. Mm-hmm. They weren't willing to come from the suburbs. So we had a partner that paid the $80 a month, and then they went out of business because they were a not-for-profit insurance started under Obamacare. Yeah. And with that, 4,000 patients went away. 4,000 patients that were getting this care from our team. Yeah. We also had a slightly different, more expensive model because we had health coaches, et cetera. You have a tighter, more efficient model that's very physician focused. So it's just a slightly different flavor.
Although we're moving, I think, in that direction. And I think that a lot of this, you know, a lot of people have questions like, how can this scale? I get this question, you know, people in the family medicine community say, oh, this is nice for you and your little patients and your little practice. Like we're not meaningful, but how can everyone do this? And so, I think that that's a big question in the DPC community is how do we replicate this? And I think it could be done in different ways, but I think myself and I think most DPC doctors are kind of skeptical of those type of partnerships.
Sure, yeah.
Because they come with a lot of strengths and there's a lot of risk. And so we're taking a lot of risk in that if our practice doesn't grow, we don't make any money,
right?
Which is the experience of a lot of us when we start.
Sure.
But, you know, it's very tempting to kind of take money or to have Medicare just pay this or, you know, get an insurance company. But I think that has some big downsides financially and potentially warping the principle of the model.
Right. Now, you've been doing it for at least 2-3 years now.
Six.
6 years?
Yeah. That's why when you were talking about the turntable thing.
Yeah.
It's chicken or the egg, I guess.
It is.
Because somewhere
you
were inspiring
me. Stole from me.
Yeah, I started in 2011.
Yeah, wow. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, December of 2011.
And actually, I was inspired by the early DPC pioneers.
Yeah.
So, like, people like Garrison Bliss.
Yeah.
And apparently yourself, because you're doing the same thing. And actually,
I was way underground.
Josh Umber.
Way underground.
Lawrence, Kansas.
Yeah.
You guys got nuked in the day after. We mentioned that.
Yeah.
Well, so one of the questions I had is in terms of scaling this.
Yeah.
So people are going to ask, you know.
Not even scale. I have a great comment for this,
Yeah.
Chad says, if these ideas are so incredible, then why do they keep closing?
No.
Who keeps closing?
Yeah, who keeps closing?
So right now, most estimates say there's 600 to 800 DPC practices in the country. Most of us are small and independent. So some of the bigger ones, like Q Lions and unfortunately
Turntable,
have closed. And those are people who are, you know, putting their necks out trying to scale this. But the majority of us are, I think there's probably more traditional practices that have closed DPC.
Than DPC.
I mean, 90% has succeeded. And success is you know, a lot of us are early in the game. But no, I most of us are not failing.
So I have a lot to say about this because obviously I was involved in one of the failures of direct primary care, but not really. Because our partners, Iora Health, are still going. We decided to pull out of Las Vegas for the reason that our big partner, we had put a bet on this particular model, and it didn't play out in Las Vegas, but that doesn't mean the model doesn't work. And in fact, on the small, like Ryan is saying, around the country, there's more DPC than ever. And what I hate is when you see an article about Q Lions closing, Turntable closing, everybody jumps on and is like, see? No, these are big venture-backed, risk-taking entities that of any venture-backed startup, most of them fail.
Well, my first response was when MySpace failed, it was at the end of social media.
Wait, MySpace failed?
MySpace.
No.
Wait, they didn't fail?
I still have my profile.
Oh, well, yeah.
Tom still has a profile.
Well, yeah.
He's Tommy T.
It's pretty dope, actually.
It is pretty dope.
I question, though. So why is that perception out there if the statistics don't back it up?
Media?
Media.
So it's really interesting. When I talk to, you know, health policy people, I think everything's just looked at through the prism of the Affordable Care Act or through the prism of politics, and we don't fit that narrative. I think a lot of people are just really confused at who we are and what we're trying to accomplish. And so if it doesn't fit that kind of political narrative, is it, you know, pro or against the ACA, I think most of us aren't interested.
This is why I think DPC is so interesting, because it's transpartisan. So what it does, it says, yeah, whatever, liberal stuff, conservative stuff, libertarian stuff, who cares? We're going to do it this way that actually works and has very little to do with politics.
Yeah.
And that's why we were talking before the show, we were trying to gauge each other's politics. And both of us were like, our conservative friends think we're liberal, our liberal friends think we're conservative, and our libertarian friends are all insane.
And everyone thinks we're confused.
Everyone thinks we're confused. And that's you and I share the same politics that way.
Yeah. Well, I would say it's a practical solution.
Yeah.
If you look at all of the pain points of primary care, I think DPC solves a lot of them.
Yeah.
Now, that's not to say that fixes the entire healthcare system.
Right.
That is not insurance. That is not neurosurgery. That is not getting run over by a bus. But if you look at the practical nature of the problems that plague primary care, that lead to burnout, that lead to patient dissatisfaction, to bad outcomes, I think DPC solves them. But the question is how do you
scale
fit the system around that?
Okay, so here's a question. Okay, all right. Yeah. So this is a good segue into what I want to talk about in tech. So one of the ways you could potentially, and I've been thinking about this quite a bit, you could potentially scale this is, look, here's the problem. Doctors, nurses, et cetera, are burning out. Patients are miserable in the current system because they're all commodified. And the incentives are backwards. Even when we're talking about macro and MIPS and quality and outcomes, it's all horse crap because—
I think we just lost 100 viewers just
Saying MIPS. So exactly. So the idea is that those things are just bandages trying to create value-based payments. Mm-hmm. But the truth is what you're doing and what we were doing at Turntable is creating value every single day we went to work because we weren't thinking about those things. We're thinking about what's the best outcome for this unique patient. Mm-hmm. And the question is, how do you get a system to focus on that? But more importantly, how do you integrate sort of information at the point of care so that you can use best practices? Yep. You can actually use all this wonderful big data and stuff that we've collected now with the Epics and the Cerners and the Athenas. And and actually, Athena's doing a thing called Athena Insights, where they're gathering data from practices around the country and finding out patterns and then giving them to the clinicians for free. They're saying, hey, guess what? It turns out most patients are getting unnecessary antibiotics later in the day when the doctor's tired and can't fight anymore. You know, these little insights, right?
Yeah.
And so the question is, how do you get that data in a direct primary care like these autonomous clinics? Yeah. I mean, it's IT.
Yeah, I mean, the word data is like a trigger word, I think, for a lot of doctors. You say the word data and a lot of doctors are probably flipping off the camera.
Do you need your emotional support cat right now? Because I can get you one.
Yeah, and I'm not like that, but I kind of sympathize with doctors in that regard. So I don't think data is good or bad. I think it depends on what data we're getting, how it's collected, and how it's utilized, most importantly. And I think up until this point, data has been kind of only collected. We don't know what to do with it.
Right.
And I think we're putting that task on top of doctors and nurses. But no one who, you know, the bean counters, they don't know what to do with it.
Right.
For the most part.
Right, right.
So we've spent, you know, decades and decades collecting all this data without really a plan to implement that. So what I would like to see as a physician and someone who has a degree in public health is for me to become a consumer of data. Not just to show me numbers, but to, you know, where does that come back on the other side? Where does it help me make better decisions?
Yeah.
And I don't see that very much in health IT.
But it could be.
And there's reasons there. Interoperability, right. You know, we could go on and on.
It'll get boring.
But I think that that's, you know, if you look at any other industry, technology, if it doesn't make it more efficient or more affordable, there's no reason for it.
So
in healthcare, we're optimizing the revenues and the payments, and that's it.
Yeah.
You know, we're not thinking about making anything more efficient or better or decision-making tools.
And let's be honest, our current generation of EHR is very good at that.
Yeah.
They're very good at revenue
optimization. Well, that's what people, you know, say. They say suck. I'm like, well, suck at what?
Suck at what?
Yeah. Suck at what you want them to do.
They do exactly what the hospital system wants.
Skynet? We haven't moved to that yet. They're doing exactly what we asked them to do.
Yeah.
For the most part.
Exactly right. Yeah. And then it becomes sentient and destroys us all.
Yeah.
Which is cool.
Yeah.
Kind of dope.
And then we just, you know, drink our LaCroix and we'll be fine.
LaCroix, delicious. You know what? I'm convinced LaCroix causes diarrhea, and I will get into that later. But here's the thing.
Don't tell me that right now. I'm like halfway through this cup.
You know what? There's nothing like
I'm going to drink up, though.
Live shart to really just kill the mood.
Our viewers might go up, though.
They might.
Yeah.
So go back to the clip, Logan. I want to see his room. So this is your...
This is a procedure room, so if I need to do something a little more extensive, I have a craftsman back there. That's for the guys.
Nice.
Everything else is for the ladies. moms, I mean.
The
my
moms,
ladies.
Right, the ladies,
And so, yeah, this is kind of a procedure room. We have some other areas in the back. We're going to start doing some kind of fitness testing, some treadmill testing, that kind of stuff.
Right.
I don't show that stuff because it gets very messy.
Right. Oh, yeah, got you.
Yeah.
Awesome. So, okay, look, you have... Okay, the beauty of your space doesn't matter.
No.
And I learned this at Turntable. We had a beautiful, shiny space. What matters is the interaction between the humans in that space.
Yes.
And does the space serve the interaction?
Yeah.
And it looks like you have a very minimalist space that serves the interaction.
Yeah, and this is my second clinic. My first clinic was even more minimalist, smaller.
Right.
And I know a lot of DPC doctors who start with like one room.
Right.
You know, it's just them. They don't even have a nurse. They don't have anyone else. And they're doing their own blood draws. And so that, you know, that may not be scalable, but I don't think you need... you know, when you make the business of medicine simple, you don't need all that stuff. I probably spent too much money in my clinic trying to impress people. But
we did the same thing.
Yeah. Not that kind of money. I mean, right, well, little turntable. Room
We had a billionaire investor.
Yeah, yeah, I didn't have one of those.
Yeah, well, you know, you need one.
I do.
It helps. It helps a lot.
Well, let me know.
But I failed and you didn't. That's the difference because you're all 100% of your skin is in the game. This is your passion project, and it was mine too, but we had a big team, we were part of a bigger company, we were partnered with IOR. It's very, very difficult, but still, that model.
Big risk, big reward.
Big risk, big reward. Now, I want to segue from that into something that I think is more universally applicable to every specialty and everybody, and that is your plan on medium.com, and we will share the link to totally revamp healthcare. So it's like new Hoffle care.
Oh, wow.
Right?
Yeah. Well, you know, the funny part is, so NuCare, I don't exactly know where that came from, but I do remember in residency, when I was kind of pitching around names, I think Obamacare was, you know, it wasn't even actually started. I think it would have been voted on, but right. someone said, you know, you're anti-Obamacare. I was like, no, not really. I just, you know, I don't think it's going to fix the big problems. And yeah. they're like, it's like Neuhoffle Care. I'm like, okay, NuCare. And so that's where that came from.
So it started
that way. That's my clinic.
That's
started.
Your clinic name.
Yeah, but it wasn't like a.
But you should know. Call this thing NuCare.
So, well, yeah.
So
yeah.
Z-Pak, check it out. Okay. Yeah. I read this thing. I didn't read. He has a 40-page, and he does this in his.
I have a degree in public health, so I'm sorry.
Degree in public health. He writes a 40-page proposal that could rival anything or exceeds anything that I've seen proposed to transform healthcare because it transforms the payment model, the care, and the insurance all at one. And then he has an executive summary that's like a page and a half.
Something like that, yeah.
The executive summary basically says this is his plan. And when I read it, I was like, this is what it takes. It takes physicians and frontline clinicians to say, in my experience, what would actually work for the American people to give us better care?
Yeah.
And if I'm understanding correctly, and you can correct me.
Okay. All right.
There are three kind of pillars of this. Mm-hmm. We'll do it this way because there's a
depends which one you introduce first. Half of the crowd is going to say this sucks, and half of the crowd is going to say
exactly. So if I talk about the personal healthcare accounts first, you're going to alienate all the liberals. If I talk about the expansion of Medicare to Medicare for all, you're going to alienate all the conservatives.
Probably.
And what's the third pillar? It was
how you pay for it.
How you pay for it.
Yeah, which pisses everyone off.
Pisses everyone off yeah. because it's a Medicare Social Security style tax.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's dependent on income, et cetera.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now that we've pissed everybody off and we have zero viewers.
Great.
My understanding of your system is this. You have a personal healthcare account
yeah.
that's about $2,000 to $3,000 or so.
Yeah.
And that pays for that much care from the beginning of that much care. And then around that is an insurance plan that is Medicare for all
yes.
that pays for the catastrophic
yeah.
stuff. So in other words, it's formalizing what you're talking about in direct primary care. Pay for the direct primary care with this personal health account.
Yeah.
And if you're poor, that account is subsidized.
For sure.
If yeah. you're rich, you pay the damn thing yourself because
yeah.
you're rich. And then...
Nobody cares about rich people.
About rich people, yeah. right. Except for our current government. But yeah. That's okay. I want to be cared about because I'm in the 10%.
Yeah, I saw your Lamborghini out there.
Yeah. Do I have a Lamborghini? It's my Camry hybrid.
Yeah.
There's somebody has a Corvette, which
yeah.
is pretty dope.
Yeah.
It's the guy who teaches the MCAT prep course down the road. They're rich as heck. So the idea then that you expand Medicare, but by expanding Medicare, you combine everything else into that. So
yep.
no more Medicaid, no yep. more CHIP,
yep.
no more anything but Medicare for all.
Yeah, I mean, I looked at it like, what is the stuff that you know the right is proposing that I think would be a practical solution, and what is the stuff on the left that would be a practical solution? And you know I think most people you know whether they're Republican or Democrat just don't listen to some of the ideas that might be good on the other side.
Right.
And so I think the personal health accounts we talk about all the time. People give lip service to being patient centered.
Yeah.
Regardless of your politics, we should be patient centered.
Yeah.
Until you say give them some of the money to control.
Yeah.
Whoa,
yeah.
let's not be crazy.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm proposing.
Yeah.
You know, if we want to say that we're patient-centric and we want to be patient-centered, you know, you have to have patients control some of those dollars.
Right.
And that's not to say that everyone has enough dollars to do that, but you know, there's various ways you can assist people. And so I think this is where the health care versus health insurance comes in, because right now the only way that I guess we assist people is to put them on some type of plan, an insurance plan.
Right.
There's other areas of assistance, like food, for example.
Right.
That we give people an allotted amount of money to go buy food, and they can shop at whatever grocery store they want, just like I do. And
right.
I think that's a great thing.
Right.
And I think as soon as you start kind of segregating people
mm-hmm.
Into these different groups, whether it be elderly people or Medicaid, that there's a lot of
stratification of care. Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah. so I think you're seeing that right now.
Yeah. yeah
I think
yeah.
that's sad. And so you know, I think that personal health accounts would really empower patients to you know not have skin in the game that they're going to lose money. I mean, I think you know lower income people, as they wouldn't lose money.
Yeah.
They wouldn't lose money. You know, this would be a subsidy, and for upper income people, not as much of a subsidy or none.
Right.
And so, but I think that they would have more control, and it would solve a lot of those problems. Transparency is something that, you know, we also, if we want transparency. Well, what does that mean? You know, if we have 14 different payers and middlemen involved in that, like, how can you ever achieve transparency?
Right.
You can't. So in DPC, you know, you look on our websites, it's going to pricing.
Yeah, here's
fees,
the price.
It's right there.
Here's our drug prices. Here's
yeah, so grocery stores, right. You know, when they're serving someone who needs assistance, they can't get away with not listing prices.
Right.
So yeah, we demand transparency, but then our system is so counter-opposed to that.
Right.
So it's never going to happen unless, you know, patients are controlling those dollars. And, you know, those fees, you know, are much more reasonable than what people think. So when I say $2,000 or $3,000, you're like, oh, that won't pay for anything.
I think a lot of prevention. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think you know, DPC is one of those few areas that is proving that healthcare could be a lot more affordable. Right. And it's not, you know, we always talk about healthcare costs and how we pay for it, but no one ever talks about how to make it more affordable.
Right.
And I think that's a huge part of it.
That's what was missing from the Affordable Care Act.
That one little part.
Yeah. Right, one little part, which is how do we bend the cost curve? It was talked about, and there was a lot of opposition to different ways to do it,
but
it never really came to fruition, and I think that's one of the... So I think what we should do is have you back on to talk about that.
Yeah, for sure.
Because that's a whole discussion in itself. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to share with the ZPAC your Medium article.
I want people
to read it. I want people to have questions. I want people to be either inspired or outraged or both.
Then
we come back.
The plan that outrages everyone is the one that's probably going to work.
That's the one that will actually get enacted.
You have to swallow your pride.
We should read some comments. Exactly. Tom, you got any comments or should I start pulling some up?
Pull one up real quick.
Carrie, tacos can go to hell. Logan Stewart. Logan, you're not supposed to comment.
That's a thing we do in the comments. We talk about tacos.
Oh, that's good. I like tacos.
Eric would like to know where and how can I find a DPC in my area?
Yeah, great. I'm glad you mentioned this. Probably the best website, the most comprehensive, is dpcfrontier.com.
Ah,
yeah, and there's a mapper on there, so if you do /mapper,
you can find one.
Yeah, and that's probably the best, you know, database. There's no like registry of us, you know. As I mentioned, most of us are underground. But you know, some communities have a lot, and other communities don't have one yet. So Kansas, I think we're up to over 20 or 30 DPC practices in the Kansas City metro area. We have 16 to 18 now. We've even formed some kind of regional organizations.
Right.
So you know, even if you Google direct primary care and wherever you're from, you might run across somebody or an organization.
Alex Wu says, turntable wasn't a failure, merely a stepping stone. That's right.
Exactly right.
You stole my ish.
Yes.
You didn't actually.
Yeah, that's okay.
We inspired each other.
Zachariah says, what I understand from the American healthcare debate is that you guys are screwed in so many ways, putting millions of dollars.
Let's get some tacos.
Right, tacos.
In danger and not having health insurance. He's a Canadian dude. Well, all you have is maple syrup, Zachariah.
Yeah.
And Justin Bieber. Bro. And Alanis Morissette.
Yeah, she only had one good album.
All I really want is straight healthcare.
I knew I would get him singing here pretty soon.
I want some insurance to cover my butt. Direct care physicians. Let's see what these. I'm gonna find a good. Let's see. I hate red tape.
Let's find one. That says I'm evil.
Oh, that's all of them.
Okay.
Yeah. Chronic idiopathic urticaria. So how do you deal with like very odd sort of, you know, zebras and stuff in your practice?
Oh man.
Yeah.
That's the beauty of
people
DPC.
People with chronic disease, fibromyalgia.
That's the beauty of DPC.
Tell me, because I agree with you.
Because you have more time.
Yeah.
I mean, I can do a pharyngitis in 10 minutes. I mean, most doctors can do it in less. I'm slow. you know, it's those really difficult conditions and difficult patients, you know.
Difficult.
Meaning,
they require multiple visits. They need to be heard.
And they need
trauma.
More time.
Right.
And a lot of them have a lot of baggage. And that's not, I'm not trying to say that in a negative way.
No, it's a fact, yeah.
But you know, it's amazing when you can spend an hour with patients and let them tell their story, like how messed up our system is.
Yeah.
You know, so I think if anyone who recognizes that, it's DPC doctors who spend so much time with them. So what I often find is that people, you know, have conditions and whether they're properly diagnosed or not, that they really don't understand them. You know, and I think when people understand what's going on with them, they tend to do better. A lot of times they get prescriptions without understanding anything.
Right. And again, this is where health IT can help too, because if you're showing the chart to the patient, the chart is taking some of this work off your plate, you know, and then you're able to just focus on the relationship. Yeah. Have you ever had a patient say, come to your clinic, first visit, and be like, and I'm here to remind you of the mess you left when you went away.
It's uncanny how often that happens.
A lot,
actually.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I just want to make sure you knew that I knew that you knew.
At least once a week.
That I knew.
Yeah.
Tom Heine, or other comments?
I'm curious, because you guys both got really mad at me when I read Chad's comment about how direct primary care is a failure. Where does the passion come from, just on a daily basis?
God. Oh, you.
Caffeine.
That's what it is. And crack.
Caffeine and cocaine.
Cocaine is a hell of a drug, bro.
Hell of a drug.
You know it. We're in Vegas. We're going to do this, brother. I got bruxism right now.
Yeah. You know, I think it's because our personal experience is so powerful. I think that most doctors I talk to, they have sacrificed so much to build their clinics, and they see the good that it does. So whenever I hear anyone kind of criticize it, I probably am a little bit too emotional in reaction because I do see the good that it does. So yeah, sometimes the media just gets annoying, and so that might be where that comes from.
I mean,
no, it's the opposite. You know, there's conferences, DPC conferences. The AFP is doing one. One of my good friends, Lee Gross, is doing one in Orlando called Docs for Patient Care.
See,
there's hundreds of doctors meeting at these things, and people don't know it.
My take is that you guys, like me, when you know I was in that game, and I'm still a firm believer. I'm an evangelist of this model. When I travel around the country talking about it, I'm talking about a DPC model, but even one that can be integrated into bigger health systems. Yeah. You know, it's a continuum. There's not a one size fits all, but there's a one concept fits all, which is give us the incentive, the space, and the tools to focus on this with our patients, and we will do an amazing job because that's why we went into this.
Give us the opportunity.
Give us the opportunity.
That's it. Yeah.
And trust us because we freaking know, all right? We may not know everything, and we need your help. IT people, we need your help.
You want to talk another pain point, Tom. What other profession do we kind of look at the profession? Let's, you know, take an attorney, an architect, that we kind of presume that all the decisions they're going to make are going to be crappy unless there's some kind of external force to make them make a good decision. Like,
right.
Should we choose the attorneys? You know, like, why do we let attorneys just go out there and just practice? Well, they passed the bar and they've learned the right. And, you know, doctors jump through a lot of hoops, like a lot, and spend, you know, a decade of their life to become doctors. And, you know, I think the let doctors be doctors, like, rings really true with me. But, you know, whenever we say that we're going to kind of incentivize carrots and sticks and whatnot, it kind of angers me a little bit because it's kind of presuming that doctors are going to make horrible decisions. Doctors do make horrible decisions, no doubt.
Yeah.
But I think we kind of look at the doctors in a different light than we do most other professionals.
Yeah, and that's a new phenomenon.
Yeah.
I think it didn't used to be that case, but I think what happens, they got so unsustainably expensive that they had to push back in that way, and now it's gone so far that we're so devalued, and it's so heartbreaking to us, and here we are like, you're doing amazing things for your patients because you had to step out of that grid.
Yeah.
And there are lots of people around the country doing that, even within the grid.
Yeah.
And look, if we can have a halfway spot where we at least enable people with good outcomes, making tools and get out of the way, and we pay people based on real outcomes that matter, not, you know, BS quality measures that don't measure quality.
That's a long show right there.
Yeah, that's a show in itself. And we can talk about that next time because I would love to have you back on the show.
Yeah.
And it's been a huge thrill, dude, because Ryan is one of the pioneers in transforming healthcare on a small level in Kansas, but on a larger level through the dialogue that we're having and on an even bigger level through the plan that he's proposing, which is one of the most sensible things that I've heard, which is why it will never work.
It's doomed.
It's doomed. And I will share the link with you guys shortly. So, guys, what's your website, by the way?
My practice website's newcare.net.
NEUcare.net.
Or new.care. I had this really hip domain name. I got the .care, so it's new.care. But then when I say that, people get confused.
They're
like a .care? And I'm like, yeah, it's all the cool kids are doing it.
I used to have a zdog.md.
Yeah.
And then no one. It's like Moldova. That's what it is.
It is Moldova.
It's a Moldovan.
We come full circle.
And so it goes. My friends, it has been a thrill, man. Really, really, really.
Thank you.
And we're going to have him back. Hit us with questions. If you're good, do you think you can peek through the comments at some point and answer some?
Yeah, tonight. So, eating tacos.
He's going to be eating tacos
Maybe
and
some
watching
bourbon.
People like a bourbon. Yeah. Now you're talking. Yeah. I can tell you the places to go. You already ate at Egg Slut. I mean, what's left not to do in Vegas?
<It's true>.
Guys, thank you to Dr. Ryan Neuhoffel, DOMPH and PIMP. Tom, any parting words?
I just want to say thanks to Athena Health. And for those of you who are aware that ZDogMD got a new cat yesterday, the top trending names on Instagram where we're taking a poll for the best name for Z's new cat are as follows. Ziggy McCat Dust, Princess DeLaLa Pity Paws, my personal favorite, Toxo.
And Toxo it is. That's amazing. Hey, Toxo, get over here. Why do I feel so ill right now?
I don't know.
I feel mildly immunocompromised. Thank you, guys. We out.
1, 2, 3. Yeah.
Yo, Z-Pack, this episode is made possible by the generous sponsorship of Athena Health. Athena Health partners with hospital and ambulatory clients to drive results. They offer network-enabled medical record, revenue cycle management, patient engagement, care coordination, and population health services to build Health 3.0. Yo, get back to the work you love doing. Athena Health, free up.